This is Femi Kuti, and you are listening to NYC Radio Live.
Hello, amigos. Feeling good? You should. Plenty to be feeling all right about. We still have our health. I know that 98% of these shows feature just music or conversations with musicians. But actually, one of my most popular ever was a conversation with the Psychonaut. You know what a Psychonaut is? They travel consciousness. Dennis McKenna and Alexandra Tenue. A great kind of sound wizard. And a comedian, Greg Barris. You can look for that episode. But anyway, I was on a retreat making music with Alexandra Tenue and some others. And the proprietor of the land is a quite well-known Renaissance man. Named Jean-Claude Van Italy. And I thought that the listeners of this podcast, the teeming thousands, would enjoy hearing and learning from this guy whose life is his art. I mean, it's really amazing how he lives, the land he's cultivated, the art that he keeps manifesting and spreading. So here is a conversation with Jean-Claude Van Italy. Before we jump in, I'll let you know that we are sponsored by the Rubin Museum of Art. Very grateful for that support. That's why you're hearing this podcast. But you can check out so much more. The year of exhibits called The World is Sound is quite amazing. They recorded tens of thousands of people saying the word Om into a little mini recording studio, and then they assembled them into something that sounds like heaven. There's a lot of other kind of stimulating and fascinating things there to enjoy. And of course, I DJ the first Friday of every month, so check me out there and come to October 21st, the Rubin Museum of Arts will be presenting our baby, the Rock is Live Festival, 24 hours of sacred sound. All right, here we are with On the Porch at a place called Shantigar. With Jean-Claude Van Italy. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. We are here with Jean-Claude Van Italy here at Shantigar, a nice, beautiful piece of land here in the Berkshire Mountains. Quite an amazing place. And Jean-Claude, when people ask you what would be on your business card of all the stuff that you do?
uh, That's a good question.
All right, maybe first question.
I laugh a lot. Mm-hmm. I wish I could put stand-up comic, but I don't dare. I'm a playwright, I guess. Mm-hmm. That was my first moniker. And from playwriting, I also some performing. I went to teaching playwriting and performing together, realizing that I could bring that together with my meditation practice. So I'm a teacher. I'm a person of the theater. I'm a meditator. I don't know. I don't know what other labels to pick up.
Right. Well, it fills up your day, apparently.
That's because I'm an obsessive compulsive. I have lots of practices that I do all the time.
Right. Well, actually, that's kind of what I wanted to start on, but maybe we should just paint the picture, because where we are definitely leaves more questions than answers, which is probably intentional.
But it's good whether it's intentional or not, I take
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So we are in this gorgeous retreat center called Shantigarh, and I've noticed dozens, if scores, of absolutely gorgeous stone carvings that look to be Himalayan or Chinese, or that's something that's going on here.
Yeah, they are mostly Asian. Mm-hmm. They just happened here somehow. The exact way they came is that I have a local friend who was an importer of Chinese antiques, particularly at a time when the Chinese were wanting to get rid of a lot of old things. Mm. So he likes Shantigarh, so he let me have them at very little price. Mm-hmm. But it seemed almost as if they wished to come here. There's a statue, there are a couple of statues, one of a little boy with his hand over his mouth, another with a little boy with a hand over his ears. I think of them as protective statues. They arrived here on the morning of September 11th, 2001.
Wow.
So now, not the morning, I'm sorry, the afternoon. So now they, I think of them as protective, that they needed to be here for us somehow or another. So although the literal way that things came was on a boat from China, mm-hmm. they seemed to appear because they were needed. My work with this land, it seems to me, has been to reveal the land rather than add anything. And perhaps the only thing that is added in terms of that, of landscaping, if you will, are those statues. But it's almost as if the land cried out, I need a Buddha here. I need a Buddha here. Just literalize a Buddha right here. Mm. So they came.
Yeah, it's a very inspiring place, a very transformative place. I know I'm, in the words of James Brown, as mellow as I can be.
Well, I'm so glad to hear it.
So I'm feeling good.
That's good. I've also wondered why this place is so powerful. Partly, I think it's powerful because it's so beautiful, and the natural beauty is so incredible. It's also very isolated, so there's a great deal of space. It's not only the beauty of the trees, say, or the open fields, or walking in the woods, but it's the space between the trees. Mm. It's how space interacts with this natural beauty. Trungpa Rinpoche, my Tibetan Buddhist teacher, was very drawn to it as well. He did a year's retreat here when he was writing his Shambhala teachings. Some people have explained it that it has to do with the electromagnetic whatever here underneath the ground. Whether that's so or not, it's a place of great strength. This town, which is in, it's Rowe, Massachusetts, R-O-W-E, is the site about 6 miles away of the first nuclear reactor in the country, which in my mind is not a good thing. Right. It was put here at the time of Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace. And my next door neighbor, Deb Katz, who is part of Shantigarh, heads up a group called Citizens Awareness Network. We closed that nuke, and she went on with Citizens Awareness Network to close three other nukes. So the power that brought the nuke and the power that brought the nuke down, the power that brings Shantigarh, the power that brought Trungpa Rinpoche, I don't know, it's mysterious, but I'm addicted to it, and I live here.
Wow. And a lot of times when people are listening to the radio, they want to know why they're listening. So they want to know that someone had some kind of measure of worldly success, because for some reason that's kind of the model we all work on. And that first hit you in the 1960s with your play. That was your first the world found out about you.
I joined the Open Theater in 1963. I was living in the Village. It was in a very exciting time in the Village. Nobody was paying the least attention to us, but we were experimenting with theatrical form. We were finding ways to express all the lies that had been told to us as we grew up in America in the 50s. We were, finding new theatrical forms. I was writing plays in new forms. The Open Theater was experimenting. Sometimes we would come up here and experiment in the fields. Sometimes the actress would improvise during the day. I would write a play the next evening, and the next morning they would work on the play. It was thrilling. It was my petty version of Shakespeare writing for a troupe.
Wow.
That was really thrilling. We suddenly broke through to fame with my play America Hurrah, which was produced off-Broadway in November of 1966. We thought it would be overlooked as being too far out, but it was an anti-Vietnam War play. It happened to hit at the right historical moment, and it ran for 2 years off-Broadway. It's been done all over the world. From there, it went to the Royal Court in London, was about to move to the West End, but the Lord Chamberlain decided that it was his last spasm of censorship, so it didn't do that. But that was the moment. We also, a year or so later, with the Open Theater, wrote an ensemble piece. I wrote an ensemble piece called The Serpent, which we toured a lot in Europe, which won a lot of prizes, and which I think remains the kind of ur ensemble piece, as close as possible a piece that was created by a group of people, of actors, coming from the actors themselves. So that seeded a great deal of what happened that later on Broadway. It seeded my play Interview, which was part of America Hurrah, was probably the form for Chorus Line. And then one of the actors that I had worked with, who was in my first play, War, Jerry Ragney, who had also been part of the Open Theater, went on and wrote Hair, which was the popularization of the work that we had been doing downtown. From there, in the 70s, I went on, and someone had asked me, actually, I was teaching playwriting at Princeton, and Dan Seltzer, who was the head of the department there, asked me to do a translation of Chekhov. I said, why ask me? I don't speak a word of Russian. He said, well, look at the other translations, and you know how to write, you know how to write good the plays.
Right.
You know how to make words in people's mouths. So I wrote, eventually wrote all the translations of Chekhov's major plays. When I say write, I was always working with the spoken word and always with an assistant who was an actor who would speak back to me. So we were working with the spoken word. I've had really good feedback from that. So my life has been greatly in the theater.
Right. And when people think about Greenwich Village in starting in 62 or so, we all have, now it's kind of iconic and we have an image. You know, I think of the Gaslight Inn, and I think of people having various opinions about Bob Dylan, and I think that people could smoke a joint walking down the street back then. I have my own images, but what do you think people might get right, and what have they gotten wrong, or what part of the story do you think is not being told or is missing?
Maybe how exciting it was.
Mm-hmm.
I've had the feeling of being in the right place at the right time. I knew it at the time. I felt that somehow the maelstrom of creativity had landed on us in the Village. Perhaps before that it had been with the Beats in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were working with the Open Theater in Lofts, when Joe Chaykin was directing it, I felt that this was new, exciting, important. It was fabulous to be there. It had nothing to do with publicity because we didn't have any at all.
Mm-hmm.
When we began performing plays, it was in theaters such as the Sheridan Square Playhouse on Sheridan Square. When they were dark, we would perform on their Monday nights. So it had nothing to do with publicity, but there was that exciting feeling that we were saying things which had not been said, at least not in a generation or two.
Mm.
That the cycle had come around, that it was time to tear down the facades. It was time to tell the truth, but to tell it in our own idiom. It was a community also. Perhaps one of the things that's not said, it wasn't that large. It wasn't like we had tens of thousands of people there. It was, I don't know how, 1,000, 2,000 over the whole Village. So we knew each other. We would go and see each other's plays. We would be in each other's plays. We would be in each other's lives. We slept with one another. We had the same aspirations. Perhaps when a lot of us came to New York, we wanted to be on Broadway. Certainly I did. That was the classical thing. But Broadway was busy with psychological realism, wasn't involved with us at all. So it was either make our own theater or don't make any theater. So it was a no-brainer, as they say.
Wow. And you were interacting with the musicians as well at that time, or was theater kind of its own bubble?
Well, I was principally involved with theater, but yes, of course we were interacting with musicians. Yeah. We were interacting with painters.
Mm-hmm.
There was a whole movement of painters who started their own galleries. There was music in many of the plays that we put on. Yes, we were very involved with the overlap of the arts, which I think is a powerful place to be.
And how much of a challenge was it to make rent in Greenwich Village back then?
Well, rent was low, but mm-hmm. of course money was cost a lot. I went from several different apartments in the Village at different times in my life, and still am in the Village. The apartment that jumps to mind from that period of time that I lived in for 7 or 8 years was at 14 Christopher Street, which is on the corner of Gay and Christopher Streets, significantly enough, for me. I paid $88.20 a month for that apartment, which was a great studio apartment. It was one big space with a big bow window looking out over a parking garage, which is no longer there. I couldn't make any rent, of course, from the work mm-hmm. we were doing. So I had various odd jobs. Eventually, I became a researcher and a writer at CBS and NBC in the religious ghetto. So I wrote for a program called Look Up and Live. I also wrote some public affairs shows. I wrote an adaptation of the Grand Inquisitor chapter in the Brothers Karamazov, for instance, for Look Up and Live.
Wow.
Made money in that way. Some people who were working in the theater were, there was one guy, Bill Macy, who was driving a cab. Mm-hmm. We pitched in on the rent for the loft that we worked in, which the first Open Theater loft was on 24th Street, two flights up. We just pitched in, and the place was, I mean, it was The walls were peeling. There were the only seats were old, run-down movie seats. And it seemed to me like heaven.
Wow. Yeah, it sounds like heaven. And, you know, you brought up living on Christopher and Gay Street. How radical was it for a person to be openly homosexual at that time?
To be gay at that time, which I was to be able to go from one country to another. You could pass, you could go uptown, mm-hmm. you could go to CBS, you could even wear a jacket, a blazer, mm-hmm. Or you could live a truly, not or, and you could live an exciting gay life. I cruised an enormous amount living on Christopher and Gay Streets. Mm-hmm. I'm not terribly fond of alcohol, so I didn't do my cruising in bars, mm-hmm. or it's not fond of me. But I cruised the streets of the village constantly. Once or twice a day, I would go out and cruise. The cruising seemed to be more important than the actual sex, although after the actual, I would bring people up to my apartment, and after we had sex, then we would have conversations. I got to meet, I later kind of totted it up in my head. It's probably in the low thousands of people
wow.
that I met.
That should be in the first paragraph of your bio.
So how, what label do you put on that? Promiscuous?
Prolific.
Mille tre.
Wow. And from what I understand, a lot of, there was so much, you know, almost secrecy around it, that there'd be many powerful people in certain industries who were all gay, from what I understand, but it was never spoken of. But then at the end of the night, they might all be in the same bars, this kind of thing.
I mean, maybe. No. Yeah, I think so. In the theater, it wasn't mentioned, but the great guys, the heroes in the theater, were frequently gay. I guess it was the year I graduated from Harvard, I came down and saw West Side Story, mm-hmm. and there, which was Leonard Bernstein and Steve Sondheim and so forth, and Jerome Robbins. when America Hurrah opened off Broadway, and was unexpectedly, it got a great review in the New York Times. Which was the thing you're supposed to get. Everybody mm-hmm. else liked it. On the second night of the run of the play, the usher said to me, after the show, he said, "Those two guys over there, say they're Leonard Bernstein and Jerome Robbins, and they'd like to take you out for a drink." So I walked over, and there were these two short guys who were Leonard Bernstein and Jerome Robbins. And indeed, they wanted to take me out for a drink. So we went out. The theater was on 3rd Avenue. It was called the Pocket Theater. We went out to Lenny's dark green limousine. He tossed a coin to a beggar that was on the street. We went into his car, all of us. One of the directors of the play, Jacques Levy, was standing on the sidewalk and just eyes wide open, because this was a really strange thing. So they said they'd like to go to a bar called the Ninth Circle, which was on 10th Street, actually. For some reason, I wasn't able to direct them. We never quite were able to get there. The reason was that street was cut off. Anyway, we walked eventually to the Ninth Circle, where we sat down. The Ninth Circle was a bar where they had bowls of peanuts on the table. So we sat there and ate peanuts. And these guys, who were to me titans, gods, sure. they said, they were talking about the people that they knew and that I would surely know soon, like Tennessee.
Wow.
And then they said to me, we've been asked to open the Kennedy Center, and we're thinking maybe we'd like to do a play of yours. I would like to direct it. And Robin said, yeah, I'd like to make a dance piece, something. So I I tried not to gulp too visibly,
mm-hmm.
but I said, I live around the corner on Christopher Street. I've got a bunch of scripts. Shall I go get some? Oh, yes, they said. Yes, yes. So I sprinted around the corner. I ran up my five flights of stairs on the corner of Christopher and Gay Streets. I reached my hand into this large closet where I had some mimeographed scripts. I said to myself, Jerome Robbins and Leonard Bernstein are around the corner waiting to see these scripts, which hardly anybody has ever cared to see before. And so I ran back around the corner and gave them the scripts, and we continued eating peanuts and they drinking and whatever. And eventually they left, and Bernstein, who was had a huge cape, had put his arm around my shoulder and said, I'm sure we'll see each other very soon, and so forth. It was as if they were welcoming me into the confrérie, or the brotherhood of the gay at that point, of the mm-hmm. gay, of the big gay theatrical guys. Although that wasn't, the word gay was not used at that point, and certainly we didn't say, oh, we're all homosexuals here together. Nobody ever said that, but that's what it was.
Right. Wow. Many worlds. So today, you're still cranking out the plays. I know you did a book. You did an interpretation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But what's the latest thing that you are that's coming off your pen or
I wrote
towards the stage?
Last couple of things. The thing before the very last thing is a book called Tea with Demons, 49 Games of Transformation, which is partly memoir mm-hmm. and partly is exactly that, including sitting meditations. It's games of transformation. And the very, very last thing is a play which is just about off the presses. It's finished. I keep tweaking it a little bit more, called The Fat Lady Sings. I'm not quite sure where The Fat Lady Sings is going to be, but it's reflective, as America Hurrah was, of the Vietnam War and our involvement in it. It's certainly reflective of the current political situation and the mythology that lies beneath it.
Mm-hmm.
And in some way relating what's going on now to the 2,000 years of patriarchy and Christ nailed to the cross.
Yeah, I mean, that you kind of anticipated what my next question, which was kind of where you see those struggles in the times of Vietnam and what the dynamics were politically and socially and how those relate to what you're seeing manifest now. And I guess you can bring it all the way back to the Romans if you'd like, or before that.
Yeah, I don't have any pat answers for any of it, but I do think that we get the events on the large, on the macro scale, and we certainly get the governance on the macro scale that reflects how we live, particularly the family structure and the lack of family structure. When families have extremely authoritarian parents or caretakers, when children are abused, you get a very authoritarian kind of government. I think that's a very important point. When you have fundamentalist families of whatever religion, you are likely to get fundamentalist governments with tyrants at the top, whether you're in this country or you're any country or the Middle East. I think those things need to be explored. I don't think they need to. I think they need to be explored not only with the head but with the heart and with a lot of courage.
Okay, and I have one last kind of question that, you know, a lot of people, we're here up at this beautiful retreat here at the Shantigarh Center here in Rowe, Massachusetts, and everybody amongst themselves are trying to figure out one of the many mysteries. And one is that I believe you're 81 years old. Is that it's correct?
Yeah, the numbers astonish me more than they do
you. Yeah, okay. So, but, you know, I think, you know, we're doing radio. But if we arm wrestled, I think you might win. I mean,
I don't know.
Well, either way.
We can try.
The point is, even the fact that you're willing to try separates you from the flock. But, yeah, I mean, you can't necessarily see this on radio. Maybe you hear it in his voice. But, I mean, you have a remarkable vitality and you know, physical and spiritual kind of energy that's palpable and literally remarkable in the fact that everybody talks about it. And from what I understand, you attribute it perhaps to some of your many practices that you alluded to.
Yeah.
So you want to take us through what these practices?
People do ask me that. They come up to me and they kind of poke me with their finger and they say, "Are you real? Is that real muscle? Aren't you supposed to be falling apart at this point? Aren't you supposed to be having senior moments and hip replacements and so forth, if not worse?" I'm going to start a Facebook group, which just to talk about that, to go into the many practices. I'm not quite sure yet what we'll call it, but probably super healthy.
Okay.
Maybe we'll have a contest to talk about how it will be. I'm talking about Shantigar and a couple of my colleagues from Shantigar, Michael Schreiber and Josh Adler, that we did a 21-day meditation challenge on Facebook, which we're going to do again in the fall. And I am going to start this group called Super Healthy so that I can share some of the practices. But there are many, many, many practices. I don't know which ones are working, so I don't dare drop any of them. Mm-hmm. They include meditation practices, plural. I think that at this point in history, we can do many practices. They don't contradict each other. They have to do also with nourishment, nutrition, conscious eating. They have to do with singing and dancing and performing. I think that those are not only our God-given right, but we need to do that in order to maintain a kind of radiant health. I pick up sticks in the woods, branches. I've been clearing a Zen path for a number of years. I love going out in the woods and just hauling these branches around. And sometimes I say to myself, "What are you doing that for? Are you some kind of crazy old hermit?" I say, it doesn't matter the image that you have of yourself. Just go pick up the next branch. So I'm happy to talk about all of them, and will on that Facebook group.
Great. Well, that's something to look forward to. And yeah, I guess we'll continue the conversation maybe next time I'm around.
I hope so. I've enjoyed your being around and enjoyed the group that was here this last weekend. It's wonderful having groups of people come up to Shantigar to do workshops.
Yeah,
well. It almost makes up for not having children.
If you want to adopt me, I'm available.
Okay,
all right. Thanks, Jean-Claude.